Ladies and gentlemen, welcome, welcome, welcome to the Sunday night edition of the French Connection. Today's date is the 5th day of July, 2009. My name is Daryl Bradford Smith. Great to have you here for another important broadcast of the French Connection's continuing fight here. We have so many things happening in our world, so much being exposed. It almost seems like you don't know where to turn anymore with the amount of information that is being placed before you. However, my discussion today with a returning guest is going to be about information that we know is going to affect everyone. Now, we know, the evidence is becoming clear what we're going to face in the autumn. Now, when in the autumn, what day, even what month, I'm going to guesstimate and say between mid-September and mid-November, we're going to see activities of a kind that are going to probably surprise a lot of people and even shock some. Many of them will have to do with the suspension of civil liberties. There will be bizarre reports being made on mainstream media about illness and worldwide problems based upon illness. Some of it's going to come from flu. Some of it's going to come from implosion of finances. Who knows if there's going to be some sort of war started? Who knows? Who knows? But there is evidence mounting that this autumn is going to be a real crossroads for all of us. It's going to be a culmination, in my view, of the efforts that these criminals have made. And I will make a caveat statement here in the beginning that I am not against all Jewish people, and I catch so much trouble for this from people. They all want to destroy my reputation for saying this, but that's fine. I've known too many kind-hearted Jewish people that are not involved in these crimes, but at the top of this crime gang and crime network happen to be criminal Zionist Jews. And that happens to be a sad fact, ladies and gentlemen, and we can't avoid the facts as they are presented to us. Anyway, my guest today, her name is Jennifer Lake. She's been looking into medical issues, and flu is one of her areas, but she's also looked into polio and into nuclear age that we have found ourselves in here in this last 100 years and so many other subjects. So I'm going to bring her up right now. Jennifer, are you with me?
I'm here, Daryl. Nice to be back. Thanks for asking.
Well, you know, Jennifer, this stuff that we keep looking into, I mean, of course, the history is pretty definitive at the early part of the last century that that people very heavily involved in Zionism were also heavily involved in medical research and setting up of medical systems, including healthcare systems, medical education, medical research. And that doesn't just mean in the United States, does it, Jennifer? I found in my own research links back to places like Pasteur and other places. What has your research discovered?
Well, just what you said, what we're looking at is a global elite that is, especially now, pushing global solutions, as they want to call them, onto everyone. So this is the internationalism that we've experienced since World War II in particular. It has a great deal to do with health law, public health law, and the science establishment in general, in the employ of the military and under the eyes of the global elites that are controlling legislation worldwide. So, you know, when we're talking about a pandemic in particular, we can see all of these issues because we have non-governmental agencies determining policy and procedure for everyone.
Well, it's interesting to me that it's a perfect fit for people to turn their individual liberty or civil liberties over to a larger entity such as a government or a municipality or somebody in the event of a non-visible but very but deadly the menace, and that comes in the form of sickness. Now, we can see that in the past, in 1918, after World War One, when people were returning from World War One as soldiers and whatnot, just at the right time, everybody was given this horrible pandemic scare to say that, look, we need central control, we need government control, we need to place restrictions on people. Your constitution, while it's a good idea, may not be what you all need. Look how dangerous all this is. And it seems like at the very time they needed to spring this sickness on the world last time, it was very. Very strategic for the criminals to have that 1918 flu.
Mm, it was, very much so. Came right at the end of World War I. I don't think people voluntarily gave up anything or clamored for anything, necessarily. These are plans that were in place. And following the public health law, when you see that, the groundwork had been laid legally for all of this to take place.
Mm-hmm.
And people surrender to this establishment because they don't know. They don't know what's really happening in science and medicine. You know, we're looking at an extreme advantage that was taken back at that time because research was very tightly controlled.
Yep.
Even doctors themselves, you know, did not have access to laboratories or the latest, updates. They were dependent on this very small research establishment to give them information about what was happening.
Well, isn't that still the case? I mean, even in my local area, my local doctor is having to go by what he's told from people at Pasteur, how he's going to react to, let's say, a new wave of Zios, a swine lab flu. And one of the problems he has is that he can't compete with their assertions that this is going to be this kind of illness or that kind of illness. And he basically has to go on blind faith. What they're feeding him is correct, and that's the same in the United States. An individual doctor in a small town or even in a major city, unless they're involved at the top, they don't know the real plans of these. They don't know the real score when it comes to these illnesses.
No, you're right. And, now that the authorities have legal power behind them, so they're required. You know, they're required to report in a certain way, and they're required to treat people in a certain way. And this is just a long-standing issue of contention between medicine and government.
Well, let me tell you a little vignette here, Jenny, and you. I'll give you just an opinion comment on it. You can get. I've got a veterinary doctor here in my area. She gives all of the cows and beef cattle and sheep and the rest of it injections of vaccines.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a pretty definitive study done when we were talking with Dr. Carley. She pointed me to a Purdue University study done on vaccinations for dogs and how it was actually sickening and killing these dogs and giving them a mastitis or whatever, and then tumors in their breast areas and all kinds of illnesses for these animals. But the same came with the blue tongue for cows and all the rest of it. And this woman having to go out by law and make sure every single animal in her region that she works with is vaccinated to the nines. They have to have every vaccination. And yet, she's probably been fed some of the truth. And here she is going out and maybe against her own ethics having to give injections to animals if she wants to practice her decided profession. She has to actually take part in the crime.
Yeah.
Even though she may know deep in her heart that what she's doing may be wrong. And I'm wondering if that's not the case for medical doctors as well. It's certainly the case for people like Dr. Day or Dr. Banks or many others. They want to keep their practice license, but they still have to go out and act in ways that they think probably are going to harm people.
Yeah, this is the dilemma. They would not be able to be licensed and be able to practice unless they follow these procedures. So
that's frightening to me, because even the people, our frontline defense against bad health has been co-opted.
Yes. Yeah. And we're also looking at literature that supports this. Even yesterday, I was reading something from the Oxford Journals, and they were talking about influenza vaccine, and they gave a figure that adverse reactions, and we're talking about very severe illness, occurs in 5 to 35% of their patients. And they make no distinction which vaccine does what, when they get a 5% rate of adverse reaction or when they get a 35% rate of adverse reaction. So, through this long-standing process of propagandizing the information, we can no longer tell, even from reading journals, whether or not these things are as detrimental as they apparently seem to be. So you have to look at very, very large trends and start assessing all these different potential causes of sickness.
Yeah.
And vaccines are just huge in there. If 35% of people were reacting with adverse reactions, there is just no way on earth that this could be ethically supported.
Well, no, and not only that, Jennifer, they don't even expect 35% of the people they're vaccinating to even contract the disease to a level that would kill them anyway, so they're actually making sick more people than would become sick if they let it go by their own declarations. In other words, if 35% of the people who they give flu shots to are coming down with secondary events that are sickening them to a serious level, that's more people than would be sickened by any flu.
Mm-hmm.
So they, by their own statistics, they're sickening more people with their vaccine than should become ill without it.
Right. And even without vaccines, if this was not at all, part of the public medicine, we certainly know enough about science and nutrition over the decades that, measures such as improving nutrition and giving that kind of good information to people would bring these numbers down even more.
Yeah.
So, it's just such an off-spectrum kind of snafu that's underway. So, it has to do with supporting bad nutritional programs.
Yeah.
I just see this as a very, very comprehensive kind of destructive measure on the population at large. So for that reason, it supports this idea then, of course, that all these very dark agendas about population reduction and global resource control, that these are very, very real, and that we need collective action to take care of this and deal with this.
Well, I've actually put a couple of recent postings on my webpage at IamTheWitness.com regarding organic farming and organic farmers, where they are actually coming in SWAT teams and confiscating their food because they did not adhere to the protocol of sale. In other words, in some places now, of course, they're saying that if you use composts of a certain quality or type, you could be sickening people. And of course, that's true if you're using human sewage waste for it. But these people are using organic, but they don't make a distinction. And so when these organic farmers don't report that they use compost, they're technically in a violation of the law. And all of a sudden, tried and true and tested methods for growing good food and good healthy things is coming under their control to the point where they're willing to put guns to people's heads and actually haul them off to jail. It's astonishing. It shocks me, Jennifer. Now let's go back here again to some of the origins of the work that these people did on their own behalf. Now, the virus stuff and the pathogens that we're talking about in today's parlance were actually some of the symptomology that I have looked at over my research tells me that they actually change names of diseases that are actually similar to diseases they had before. In other words, let me give you one example, and maybe you can carry on from there. We know that hemorrhagic fevers and hemorrhagic bleeding out diseases have been around a while. And we also know that some of the people who died in the 1918 flu were had showed symptoms and signs of a hemorrhagic type of swelling in their lungs, and even some of them had polio type of symptoms. But it, all they needed to do to make everybody seem like they were in the same boat is change the name and say, oh, well, it's not polio anymore, it's meningitis. Oh, it's not meningitis anymore, it's Ebola. And they keep switching names around, but frankly, it seems to me that a lot of these diseases are just add-ons to what they've already been giving out in the past.
Yeah, that's very true. You know, as they got better at diagnosis and, you know, understanding the complex relationships in biology and how we can, you know, process certain kinds of chemicals and how we produce them in our body, these were very fine points put on distinctions that separated one disease from another. So, you know, either depending on which cells were dying in abundance or what kinds of, you know, chemicals were being excreted in the system, by the system, these then began to become a very complex set of criteria that would distinguish one disease from another. You know, polio, as you mentioned, is a very good example of something that was a blanket term.
Yes.
For a very long time.
Yes.
And then through, you know, propaganda and political means, polio needed to become a victory in this establishment of public medicine. So when the vaccine came along, when Salk made his vaccine, when Sabin made his vaccine after him, this was seen as a golden opportunity to design a victory for the medical establishment. And so polio, which was a blanket illness, then went away in the sense that the diagnostic criteria changed. And so it became just a list of other kinds of diseases.
There you go. That was my point. And what Nancy Banks has defined here for us also, that AIDS is not a specific disease, but a list of symptoms that they make a diagnosis from. And it could be anything as much as bad nutrition mixed with coming down with a flu, all the way to, you know, somebody's caught a bacterial infection in their, whatever. And all of a sudden, if you add these together, they call it AIDS, when in fact AIDS has, she told me this in the last show, the AIDS virus as such, or the AIDS antibody that they keep talking about, has never really been synthesized in the lab.
Mm.
Can you imagine they haven't even identified it? All they're identifying is markers that point to bad health of your immune system. But that doesn't mean AIDS.
Right. Right. And so, you know, it's allowed to exist in the public's mind that, you know, AIDS is a result of something called the HIV virus.
That's right.
So we have the same problem here with all these other diseases. And when you start digging into the history of these, it's astonishing. It's like, where's the proof? Where's the evidence of that? You know, just example after example. So the way I see it, you know, is that we're just in this continuum of disease. And that, you know, we really need to get at the roots of this problem and start looking at the ideology that was driving it. And so, you know, that's where I've cast a big net over history, and medical history in particular, to find some of the sources of that. And, you know, it's very interesting. I was looking through some of my old notebooks, and I found a quote from Descartes, you know, and as a philosopher that, you know, was upheld during this time when the medical breakthroughs were changing and chemistry was becoming to the fore. This was going to fuel modern industrialism. He said at that time that for human beings to advance that and improve themselves, that the one thing that was most likely to bring that around would be the practice of medicine. That's kind of spooky to me. We're looking at, you know, a subterfuge in science in order to change and alter human beings. And that seems to be so prevalent now. This is what we face now. We're looking at genetic medicine. You know, we really need to take into account what's going on with viruses and the whole spectrum of virus. So, to me, it's about getting back to fundamentals again and really having more of us become wise to this knowledge. And we need to know that viruses are not living organisms, for one thing. They've been described as crystalline proteins, that living organisms produce this. These are an effect, not a cause. That when you poison someone, their body will produce virus to deal with the damage. And so as the world gets more chemically complex, we're actually able to create more kinds of virus. And consequently, the medical establishment is keeping pace with this. They're devising new kinds of tests to detect these very, very distinctive sorts of DNA, because that's what virus is. It's DNA. I've called it a smart chemical in the past. And it's simply a natural process for us. And it's been theorized that this is a necessary our adaptive evolution. So even when you prevent these things from occurring, or if you were to, you know, give virus to the whole population at large, you would actually steer adaptive evolution for the species by doing it.
Well, now what Nancy talked about, Jennifer, and I'm going to throw this back to you as a kind of a setup question here. She talked a little bit about the mitochondria coming from the mother, and it's our dual immunities coming half from our human genetics, and then half from the family, that from our mother's side of our genetics. And when we start playing around with vaccines and injections of sorts, what we start doing is destroying that mother's innate immunity and getting rid of a million years of biology that has served to protect us from a whole host of invaders. And when we weaken that, and we can weaken also the mitochondria with pollution, with radiation, with all these different things, when we can't fall back on our natural defenses that should have been in us naturally through our mother, because we've killed it off, they come riding in on their black horse, and they give us these injections saying that this will replace the protection the mitochondria once gave you. And in fact, what it does is just leaves you a listless, sort of sickly vessel, as opposed to a robust vessel that could have been living a robust life. And I'm paraphrasing what I remember from Nancy's discussion with me, and it seems like this fits right into what the goal of these criminals is to produce substances that substitute for that mitochondria, which is being destroyed by the actions they're taking.
We have very delicate relationships biologically, chemically, and this is disrupting those balances in us in innumerable ways. And, you know, I just see this as sort of an attempt to reinvent the species, more or less. This is what's going on, I think. And, you know, it's sort of beyond just, you know, the use of medicine at this point. We really have to look at this as a strategy, as an effort to control the population. They treat us like a commodity and would harness us into systems of socialism. We're we have to take all this into consideration, Dal.
Well, now, who's the they you just mentioned in your research? What kind of groups or organizations within medicine or within research are the they that you've discovered?
Well, there are so many they. You know, when we go back in history, we're talking about the cartels that existed in medical research. People who funded it and built these establishments and then supported this very narrow kind of chemical medicine in the past.
Mm-hmm.
In the United States, we're talking about Rockefeller. And, you know, Rockefeller money just went into all avenues of civil life. We're talking about medicine and education in particular. And people who were hired to administrate Rockefeller funding. So this boils down to individuals who were at the top of certain institutions. And what I've brought up in the past is the Flexner family.
Yeah, yeah.
A great deal of administration for Rockefeller funding.
Yeah.
So, and I think they played an incredibly huge role. And, of course, they're a well-known Zionist family to us.
Yep.
We know who they are. And we're talking about other sources of funding as well, the people who are less known, such as the Strausses, the Strauss family. I wrote articles about this. Nick Strauss was the owner of Macy's department store. He owned another big store. But he had a fortune, and he was also a well-known Zionist. And he took his cause to pasteurize milk.
Yeah, yeah.
Back in the 1890s. Now, what's very interesting when you start sort of putting all of this information together, and you learn about how valuable and important it is for mammals to have milk from their mothers, and you realize that a great deal of effort and money went into altering this relationship. Nathan Strauss bought his way into this. He paid for laboratories. He became a politician in New York. At one time, he was the president of the New York City Board of Health. And they were able to implement these policies to interfere in these delicate biological relationships that we have. And so, in my mind, this is the beginning of diminishing us as vigorous, healthy people. And, you know, it's almost overwhelming when you look at this growth of this establishment that has really set out to oppose our best interests.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, Jen, I've seen other things. I mean, even more not as well-known things in research, such as even in the polymer research area, plastics, where they know that a certain hardening chemicals that go into polymers to make them rigid give off a pseudo hormone or a hormone similar substance that cause men to produce large sums of estrogen in their bodies, which accounts for, and I believe accounts for a large amount of the feminization of the male species, making us all kind of like there's no distinction anymore. It's hard to find a real man. I mean, everybody's becoming girly, and they find out that there's been a lot of stuff going on with hormone control. And it's a shocker when you start seeing that it just doesn't, it's just not medicine, it's actually manufacture of things that they're doing it with. The injection of our cows with the hormones, and then when we eat the beef, we're getting growth hormone, and we're getting antibiotics, and so we're invaded, even if we're trying to stay pristine in our approach to living. If we're drinking out of certain kinds of cups, we're getting estrogen. If we're eating beef from the store, we're getting hormones and antibiotics. In other words, it's almost unavoidable, is my point. So it's multifaceted, and many groups of different industries are involved in this.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you go all the way into the manufacturer now. It's somebody had a very interesting thing on the internet about Monsanto, and they had a sign. I think I read it to you or something. It says owning the world's food supply or something. But I mean, that's not far from the truth. They put out beautiful green peppers that look perfect on their shelves, but when you send it to a lab for study of mineral and content and the rest of it, all you've got is kind of a piece of plastic sitting on your table rather than something nutritious.
Right. So, you know, this is a huge area of concern for us that even the representation of foods that are supposed to be very good and nutritious for us are actually empty.
Yes.
And so, you know, this is all part of what we need to educate ourselves about, is how to make the best use of food so we can take care of ourselves and be healthy. And, of course, we're salmon swimming upstream here. We obviously have all kinds of laws and regulations coming down that seem to rather overtly want to take away our ability to take care of ourselves.
Yes, Codex Alimentarius, which, of course, is going to take away our right to have access to herbal solutions and things that have actually, in many ways, have been time-tested. Jen, I'm concerned that this element of the conspiracy that we're talking about right now is probably the most underreported and in the long run, the most damaging. We haven't even talked about fluoride. We haven't even talked about Prozac in our water supply. The point I'm trying to make here is, or the chemtrails that are being sprayed down upon us with barium in it, which is a radioactive element. The point is that this is so multifaceted. People just think it's a geopolitical takeover, but yet our biology is under as much assault as our political system.
And probably more so, and for very long standing, I would say. When we're talking about the people that I mentioned, you know, we're going back to right after the American Civil War. So the 1850s and 60s, you know, this time period, this was happening then. And this was when chemistry was just exploding as far as knowledge goes. And very closely at this as a source, you know, this is the root of having this whole medical paradigm begin to develop and change. And, you know, up through the 1900s, this became part and parcel of the military establishment. So that medicine has always been something that has had military value.